Good morning, everyone. I now call this remote meeting of the House Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order. We're going to start with taking the roll.
Chair Long.
Present.
Vice Chair Akam.
Present.
Minority Lead Swedzinski.
Present.
Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Bowe. Representative Bowe. Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Franson. Representative Franson. Representative Grunhagen.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hornstein.
Present.
Representative Igo.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Present.
Representative Lippert.
Present.
Representative Lislegard.
Present.
Representative Meckland.
Present.
Representative Munson. Representative Munson. Representative Stevenson.
Present.
Quorum is present. So we have two sets of minutes to approve from last week. Representative Akam, did you have a chance to take a look at the minutes from January 12th?
I did, Mr. Chair, and I move approval.
Representative Akam moves approval of the minutes from January 12th, 2021. Any discussion? We'll take a voice vote on this motion then. If everybody will unmute themselves, please. All those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The minutes are adopted. And now we have the minutes from January 14th, 2021. Representative Akam, have you had a chance to review those?
I did, Mr. Chair, and I move approval.
Representative Akam moves approval of the April 14th minutes. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? The minutes from April 14th are adopted. We have some terrific presenters today, and we're going to hold questions for our first two presenters until the end of their presentation, then we'll take questions on them, and we will then move to our third presenter and take questions after his presentation. But first, we're going to be hearing on the gas emissions reduction report. And our first presenter is Frank Kolash, Climate Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Mr. Kolash, please unmute yourself and begin.
Thank you, Chair Representative Long, and thank you all members for having me this morning. I'm pleased to be able to present this report and the data that we generated along with the Department of Commerce. Again, my name is Frank Kolash, Climate Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I go by he, him pronouns. I will go through these slides relatively quickly to ensure that we have time at the end for questions. There is quite a bit of data to go through, so please bear with me while I go through our presentation and the discussion that we'll have afterwards. So to begin, we look at the total greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota. And we added in this legislative report data for 2017 and data for 2018. And what we saw was a slight increase in emissions from 2016 up to 2017 and now 2018 at 161 million tons of greenhouse gases within Minnesota. This chart shows that total emission, but it also shows on the green line what our Next Generation Energy Act goals would be. Based on the 2007 and statute, looking for a 30% reduction by 2025 and an 80% reduction by 2050. And with our current trajectory, we are not on track to meet either the 2025 goal or the 2050 goal. We did not meet the 2015 goal. So that highlights some of the purpose and the urgency about why we need to be continuing to track our emissions and identifying the sources and the sectors to focus on. So breaking down that emission a little bit more, this chart shows the contribution from the major sectors within the greenhouse gas inventory that we compile. On the left, you see transportation is the largest sector by just a little bit, compared to electric generation and then the agricultural, forestry, and land use, providing about 70% of the total emissions within the state. And then some of the smaller sources that, while they are smaller, they are going in the wrong direction. So what we'll see with transportation, where we have a slight decrease, the greatest amount of decrease happening in the electric generation sector, both in electricity generated within the state, but also emissions associated with electricity imported in the state. That's required by the greenhouse gas emissions inventory. For the agriculture, forestry, and land use, that is a more varied picture, and we'll talk about each of these sectors more specifically. But what we do see is that the electric generation sector is the only sector that is on target to meet the Next Generation Energy Act goals for 2025. And again, highlighting that those three major sectors are the ones that I'll spend more time on today and that we spend in the legislative report, because they do comprise the vast amount of the greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota that we can focus on. So they are a total of more than 70% of our emissions in state. So looking at then each an individual sector, we'll start with transportation. It is the largest source of emissions in Minnesota. It's most in need of swift action because of the changes that have happened at the federal level and the need for transportation and moving people and moving products and things around the state. So what we see is that also when we look at the data, that the light and medium duty vehicles make up more than half of all of the transportation emissions. So it's really the types of vehicles that we drive every day that are driving this sector and the modest decreases that we've seen. And the modest decreases that we have seen have been primarily due to fuel economy standards at the federal level and then vehicle emission standards that just until 2020 were harmonized at the federal level, but they were rolled back in 2020. So looking at then a little bit more deeper at the sources of emissions in this sector, we see that with light duty trucks, passenger vehicles, and heavy duty trucks, these are all engines that use gasoline or diesel and run on our roads. They really comprise more than 20% of our emissions. And so that's where we want to be focusing our attention on how to reduce emissions from these sources. The Clean Cars Minnesota rulemaking is one area to focus on reducing emissions from light-duty trucks and passenger vehicles. And then also building out our electric vehicle infrastructure charging supports those policies and supports the choices that can be made on electric vehicles that will have reduced emissions. And then also we're using our Volkswagen settlement for also replacing some of the heavy duty trucks, making sure that they're the cleanest, most efficient vehicles going forward, and also looking at some of those options where they can be electrified to reduce their emissions. And also using some of our Volkswagen funding to support that electric vehicle infrastructure. And then the Department of Administration has received some bonding funding to also help build out EV infrastructure in the state of Minnesota. So within transportation, we've seen a modest reduction of 7% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions since 2005. And some of the targeted actions that we need to focus on are, again, implementing the clean car standards, looking at the use of biofuels and other low carbon or cleaner fuels within the liquid fuels that we use for the transportation sector, looking at what the MnDOT's Sustainable Transportation Advisory Council has put forth, and then helping build out the electric vehicle infrastructure and looking for other ways based on communities and other that have about getting people around, their ability to move around in different ways than just with a. The next sector that we'll focus on, and the next largest sector, is electric generation, and it's very close in the emissions to the transportation sector. This is the one sector, as I said earlier, that hasn't seen significant progress going forward, and that's been due to the state's renewable energy standard, the electric efficiency standard, and then other efforts, especially by our regulated utilities, to continue to drive down their carbon emissions, and then also the replacement with both within Minnesota generation and with generation from outside of the state on lower cost zero emission or low carbon fuels to provide the electricity for Minnesotans that we need. So again, looking a little bit more closely at what the emissions are within this sector, we see we still have a significant amount of emissions coming from the use of coal to generate electricity in Minnesota, but that is going down. That's going down because coal is now being replaced significantly with renewable energy, wind and solar, but also some replacement with the lower cost natural gas and lower emitting natural gas. And then we do see imported electricity, both the emissions have gone down because the generation of electricity from those imported sources has become cleaner, because those states are also seeing the similar dynamics that Minnesota is seeing with lower cost renewables, lower cost natural gas driving down those emissions. But we've also seen reduced imported electricity in Minnesota. So in total, we've seen about 17 million tons reduction since 2005, and that will continue to go down based on the announcements that Xcel Energy has made and that Minnesota Power has made and that you heard with Great River Energy being made. We do see an increase in natural gas, and that's being due to low cost of natural gas and also the role that natural gas plays in backing up renewable energy and especially the wind and the solar to make sure that there is adequate electricity at all times. So again, this is the one sector that is near to meeting the Next Generation Energy Act goals, 29% reduction. That went up a little bit in the most recent numbers because of what we were seeing were some summers that were warmer and more humid, requiring more electricity, and then also some winters that were more cold, requiring some additional heating load. And then the action that we're really looking forward to is moving ahead with the 100% clean energy standard and work and the package that I think Jessica may talk about a little bit later. To the next sector, largest sector is the agriculture, forestry, and land use. And this is a complex grouping of emission sources. So I'll have a few additional slides for this group, but they are complicated. They do vary year to year, that there is forestry carbon storage impact that we calculate and work with the Department of Natural Resources on calculating for that. And it also includes emissions of nitrous oxide and methane in Minnesota, which are considered high global warming potential gases, or gases that are more potent warming gases than just carbon dioxide. Now, when we do the calculation, we use carbon dioxide equivalents to make it so that they are comparable, but this source is emitting gases that are more efficient global warming gases than just carbon dioxide from combustion. So this is a variation of a chart that we started with, and what we did here was break down within the agriculture, forestry, and land use sector, because it is complex, the major signals here. And here's where we can see that agriculture on the whole is at a similar level to transportation, electric generation. And so it just highlights the need to continue our focus on seeking ways that we can reduce emissions from agriculture. And that includes both crop agriculture emissions and animal agricultural emissions. We also see here that forestry is a negative emission. That means we are storing carbon on our landscape, using our forests as a mechanism to store carbon and reduce our emissions. And then the land use part, that is really looking at inland waters. It's the amount of soil and biogeochemical processing that happens in our rivers and streams that releases methane and carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere. There is a signal that comes from that. We do include that in our emission inventory. So then bringing up the line graphs and showing out how they stack out, we see crop agriculture is the largest source of emissions in this sector, and it is going up modestly, and that is due to just more acres being put into production. We do have some targets, and we've been working with Department of Agriculture and the Board of Water and Soil Resources on opportunities to reduce greenhouse gas impacts, reduce emissions, build soil carbon, build soil health, protect water quality by land practices, land management practices, and crop agriculture. We're very excited about that. The governor has set forth a target of 1 million acres added into these kinds of management practices, and right now we are about two-thirds of the way there on achieving that. Animal agriculture is then the next largest part of that, and that's coming from a lot of the methane that's coming from the waste management, from the waste, the manure of the animals, and then also you see the forestry growth. as a negative impact. That's where we're storing graph. And that is very noisy because we're trying to make that estimate on a year-to-year basis, which does get impacted by weather and how quickly each surveyed forest is regrowing. So overall, the total sector has seen a 2% reduction, but as you saw, it's a very noisy part of the inventory. And that really what we're focused on is increased adoption of best management practices, especially in the crop agriculture area, because we see some significant opportunities to have cost savings for the farmers who implement these types of activities, but also improvements in soil health, ability to protect water quality, and the ability to protect the climate. Now, I'll take the remaining four sectors and really talk about three of them together, and the major part of those will be what I'll term as buildings, even though that they are the industrial, the residential, and the commercial sector. It's mainly what we're seeing there are the emissions of combustion of fossil fuels for heating of buildings in our residences, in our commercial properties, but also in industrial processes. So within the industrial sector, we're seeing fossil fuels, that's being natural gas, oil, and some coal being used both to heat their buildings, but also to heat their processes. And then one thing I want to make sure that's clear is when we look at the chart, we're not seeing the emissions that are coming from the use of electricity at these buildings, because those are included in our electric generation sector emissions inventory. And that's just the way that we construct that. We don't want to double count those emissions. So looking at this chart, we're just seeing again the role that natural gas plays in our buildings. And this is primarily to provide heating for the spaces within our buildings. The industrial does have some of that, again, going to provide heat for their industrial processes. And this is a particularly important sector. It is growing in all of these sectors. They're growing. They're growing due to economic demand, consumer demand. Natural gas is a low price fossil fuel used for heating right now. So it's very useful and widely used. And it's also a challenging area because all of these decisions are made by individuals, either in their home or individual building owners, and making the ability to ensure that we can provide the heating, the space heating, and the process heating for the industrial sector, while also looking at opportunities for reducing natural gas emissions. And that's where we see an interplay between the significant emission reductions we have within the electric generation sector to be able to electrify and provide clean electricity, low carbon or zero carbon electricity for these other sectors to move forward. So our path forward is again to highlight that with the progress that we've made with electric generation emission reductions, and that we foresee going ahead with the announcements that have been made by our regulated utilities and other utilities moving to low carbon or no carbon emission sources and the targets that they're setting, that really provides a leverage point for us to use that clean electricity in other sectors of our economy to reduce the emissions. We really do need to focus on accelerating the pace of progress in the other sectors. We have a number of items that we're focused on within the transportation sector, both electrification and the use of cleaner biofuels to reduce those emissions. And then using that clean electricity to work for emission reductions in some of these other sectors, and then identifying land management practices in the agricultural sector that build multiple opportunities for us. And then we also, based on the executive order that Governor Waltz signed in 2019 around climate change, we want to make sure that we are expanding our engagement with Minnesotans to identify the ways to reduce our emissions and address this existential crisis presented by climate change and build resiliency into our communities and into our natural resources and our landscape. And then finally, we really want to leverage all the work that we are working on right now, which includes the work of the Climate Change Subcabinet, bringing together 15 agencies within the administration to make sure that we're all moving in the same direction on climate change to reduce emissions and identify opportunities for building resiliency and adaptation, and focusing on ensuring that our movement and mechanisms are building out on equity and addressing the equitable issues that we face. But we also have the Governor's Advisory Council on Climate Change, which are 15 citizens named to assist the subcabinet in identifying opportunities and barriers and ensuring that we are addressing the equity call for in the executive order. And then we're also wanting to continue our work following up on the Governor's Council on Biofuels, their recommendations that were sent out last year, because they do have some excellent opportunities for emission reductions in the agricultural and the biofuel sector. We're continuing to follow up with MnDOT's Sustainable Transportation Advisory Council recommendations and working on those, because, again, focusing on the transportation and the multiple opportunities that we have. And then also with focusing on the Minnesota Climate Adaptation Partnership to ensure that we are focused on our ability to build in and adapt to the changing climate that is already built into the system due to past emissions. And we're building resiliency into our communities and into our natural resources so that we can all thrive as even as we address the changing climate. And that concludes my slides. And I think that you want to go to Jessica next. Is that correct?
Yes, thank you so much, Mr. Kolesh. I really appreciate that helpful presentation. So we're going to hear from Ms. Burdett with the Division of Energy Resources at the Department of Commerce as well on the greenhouse gas report, and then we will take questions. Ms. Burdett, when you're ready.
All right. Good morning, Chair Long, representatives. Thank you for the opportunity to provide a little additional context for the electric power sector and emissions reductions drivers that have occurred in the sector. I'm going to share my screen now with my presentation and get started. All right. So again, my name is Jessica Burdett. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Commerce and Energy Resources. I manage energy regulation and planning, which includes our rates function, resource planning, as well as oversight of the Conservation Improvement Program. In the Division of Energy Resources, we have a variety of functions, including promoting clean, reliable, and affordable energy for Minnesota businesses and homes. We advocate on behalf of the public interest in state and federal regulatory proceedings. We maintain state emergency energy assurance and recovery plans and a variety of other responsibilities. We execute these responsibilities through five different units, including my unit, Energy Regulation and Planning, the State Energy Office, the Energy Assistance Program, Energy Environmental Review and Analysis, and Telecommunications. So the next few slides capture some of the generation mix changes over time, future drivers for emissions reductions, and the role of efficiency and conservation as a driver of emissions reductions. Commissioner Arnold looks forward to coming this Thursday and talking about the administration's clean energy package. And so I'm just going to talk a little bit about what is and answer questions as I can. So since 2005 to 2019, we've seen a significant shift in our generation mix from electricity over time. Advancements in clean energy show we can reduce greenhouse gas emissions economically while meeting the needs of Minnesota communities, businesses, and residents, as we've been able to maintain affordability, reliability, as well as minimizing the impact on the environment. The emissions reductions in the electric power sector have resulted from statewide policies such as the renewable energy objectives, as well as aggressive conservation policies working in tandem with market forces such as lower natural gas prices and lower prices for renewables such as wind and solar. In Minnesota, utilities continue to close coal-fired power plants and replace power generation with a mix of renewables and supported by natural gas during times of high demand. As a result of all of this, you can see from the chart on the left that we've increased our generation mix from 2005 for renewables from 6% to 24%. And we've increased our natural gas generation, electricity generated from natural gas from 5% to 21%. And then we've reduced our coal generation mix by almost half, from 62% down to 30%. The remaining percentages are from nuclear generation, which has maintained, and then other generation such as hydro generation and biomass, which make up a small portion of our portfolio. So as we look forward, we have we still have some coal fire generation that remain on the system, but most of the emissions reductions have come from retiring coal-fired electricity and are going to continue from retiring coal-generated coal-fired electricity generating facilities. Recent and upcoming decisions made by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commissions are expected to continue to drive down emissions reductions, and the department will provide economic analysis to ensure affordability and reliability and continued emissions reductions before the commission as they're making these decisions. Additionally, some utilities are beginning to seasonally dispatch existing coal-fired generating units, ensuring economic operations with the potential for lower emissions. The chart on the left shows the remaining units that are in Minnesota that are either under a current commission order for retirement or they are being studied for retirement. So we have a few units within municipal public utilities such as Hibbing, Minnesota Power, Otter Tail, and XL Energy. So over the coming couple of years with integrated resource plans, we'll start to see finalization of retirement plans for some of these remaining facilities. Then I wanted to point out the importance of efficiency and conservation and its role in reducing demand and emissions. Just in the last 2 years that we have data available from 2017 to 2018, electric utilities have continued to meet, if not exceed, their conservation improvement program goals, which is one of the more cost-efficient options for saving energy, reducing demand, as well as reducing emissions. During the 2017 and 18 years, the goals were exceeded by both the electric and natural gas utilities. There were over 15 trillion BTUs saved, which is, to put it in kind of social math context, enough energy savings to heat, cool, and power more than 160,000 homes for 1 year. It's also enough, the CO2 emissions have been reduced by almost 1.8 million tons, which is equivalent to removing over 350,000 vehicles from the road for 1 year. So we can see there's a sizable impact from not only just generating with cleaner sources of energy, but also from reducing how much we use when we demand it, and the cost efficiencies that come from that. So that's just a little bit of context, additional context for what Frank presented in the electric power sector emissions reductions, how we've been able to be successful, and what to expect to some extent moving forward. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. I don't have a phone a friend on with me today, so I may have to punt and get back to you on some questions, but happy to answer as I can. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Burdett. Thank you both for the terrific presentation and for the excellent work that you and your teams have done pulling together these reports. Always look forward to reading them every 2 years when they come out, and I think this is your first public presentation of the report, if I'm not mistaken, since it just came out last week. It includes some discouraging news, right? We are not on track still to meet our statewide emissions goals, and our emissions have actually gone up a little in the last couple of years. We've also seen some of the sectors, as you point out, grow in emissions over time since our baseline year. So that's certainly discouraging, but I think the bright side, the encouraging news, is looking at the power sector and seeing the significant decreases in emissions over time that we've seen there. And so my question for the two of you is, we know that these sectors interact in a lot of different ways, and I'd be curious to hear how far you think the power sector emissions reductions can get us in reducing emissions in those other sectors, for example, with electric vehicles or with electrifying some of our heat needs for buildings. Maybe we'll start with Mr. Kolash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. I, you know, certainly, you know, getting to a quantitative response to that is challenging. Requires quite a bit of understanding of the modeling and moving forward. But clearly, the work that we've been focused on and others throughout the country have been looking at as far as reducing the emissions from the electric generation sector. It is the foundation for achieving significant reductions in these other sectors. And with the Minnesota Department of Transportation last year, in 2019, we put forth a report that showed that there are very large emission reductions possible, especially in the post 2035, 2040 years with electric use in motor vehicles. And that's where we're going through the transition for electrification. The opportunities and some of the challenges that we face in Minnesota, where we still need the heating down to very cold temperatures, or the replacement of natural gas and other electric heat pump sources for that. But looking at how much reduction it is, significant, both based on what we've seen from the electric generation sector, but the ability to then leverage that in other emission sectors going forward as we move ahead. And then I'll save some time for Jessica if she wants to add to that.
Thank you. Ms. Burdett?
Thank you, Chair. I think Mr. Kolash did a very nice job summarizing the challenge and the opportunity. There definitely is opportunity, and I think that we can use electrification in the transportation sector as well as the heating and use sector as a tool to further reduce emissions, while also balancing concerns around affordability, reliability, and making those aggressive emissions reductions that we need to make. I think we have existing policy tools to make that happen, but can certainly add to the suite of tools to continue to drive down those emissions. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Burdett. And I'll just note there was a really interesting New York Times chart this morning on the affordability question where they compared the lifetime use cost of using an electric vehicle versus a combustion engine vehicle and found that in most cases, electric vehicles are actually cheaper over the lifetime use. Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think my question is somewhat related to Chair Long's question, and it's really, thank you for the report. I read it and found it very interesting and very informational. And one of my comments about the report is that I appreciated in the electricity and transportation and land use sectors, there were some recommended actions provided. And while those sectors are going down, they're not going down very much. I guess my comment and question for you is that the remaining sectors, commercial, industrial, and residential are all going up quite significantly, and yet there were no real recommendations for how to turn that tide a little bit. So I'm just wondering if I think it would be important for there to be some emphasis on those, especially since they are going up. Certainly, I don't want to see transportation emissions slow in any way in how they're decreasing, but I do think there needs to be some emphasis on those other sectors. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about what those recommendations should be and maybe just a little understanding why you didn't include recommendations in those sectors.
Mr. Kolash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Akam. Those are very good points. And thank you for that comment. And we didn't include some of the more specific recommendations for those areas for two major reasons. One, they are smaller sectors, although they are going up. They are smaller sectors within the total emissions inventory. But also, I would say that based on the analysis, some of the specific policy points and policy levers are not as well defined, especially for the industrial sector and the commercial sector and the residential sector, where we know where the emissions are coming from. It's identifying the opportunities to replace those with other sources of space heating or cooling or process heating. That is the challenge, and it's a challenge not that Minnesota is facing along with many other states. And again, especially I'll take the industrial sector as an example, is each state's industrial base looks a little bit different. And so in order to identify opportunities to reduce emissions within those industrial processes, takes a more granular look at what is possible and what's appropriate and what's needed and what meets both the industrial source needs, especially if it's for process heating. And then also within the industrial sector, we just have to face the basics of chemistry and thermodynamics, that some of these are chemical reactions that are releasing carbon dioxide. We'll need to look for other ways to offset those emissions. And then within the residential and the commercial, looking again, that's a lot of space heating. And it's, where is the technology development at and the ability to use electrified opportunities to replace natural gas? And those are developing, but they're still very early, and we're working with a number of groups that are looking at the opportunities to reduce natural gas, especially in the residential and commercial sectors, but that work is still very early on, and understanding that. And then continuing to look at how efficiency, building efficiency, really plays into that it's not just a replacement of the combustion sources, but it's making our buildings more efficient going ahead, and then figuring out how to increase the efficiency of our existing buildings as we go forward.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Kolesh. I certainly appreciate the challenges that are there. I just think it will be important now and going forward that we identify those challenges so that we understand what we need to be focusing on in order to accomplish them. And so I just wanted to highlight that. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Kolesh and Ms. Burdett, for the presentation today. Mr. Kolesh, I was particularly interested in the slides where you had disaggregated agriculture and forestry and land use, and it seemed like agriculture and transportation and utility sector were pretty close when that happens. Do you know where agriculture would rank on its, if it's disaggregated or separated from forestry and land use in relation to the other sectors as far as greenhouse gas emissions are concerned?
Mr. Kolesh.
Yes, Representative Long and representatives, it would rank really nearly within a tie for third, a tie with those three. They really are very close. They're within a few thousand or tens of thousands of tons. So it really is in the top third. And then I can pull up the exact numbers for you here in a moment and provide that immediate answer just to make sure I don't give you the wrong answer. But it is, as you saw with the charts that we were showing, that the transportation, the electric generation, and the agricultural sector, they're all really very close in the magnitude of their emissions. And that's why we are particularly interested in identifying emission reduction opportunities with that. And I will do a quick numbers check so I can give you the ranking for 2018 here. I'll just need to jump to another screen.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Kolesh. Yeah, that was what my eyes were saying on quick glance too. And that gives me a sense of urgency related to agriculture as well as transportation too. And I'm hearing the same from farmers when it comes to best management practices, or farmers that are saying, hey, these practices are really making a difference on our farm. They're helping our soil, helping our bottom lines, and we can be a part of the climate solution. We just need some more support for financial assistance and some technical assistance too. So one thing I would just mention, I really appreciate the goal to get 1 million acres into these best management practices, and that we're getting close to that. But with 25 million acres of farmland in Minnesota, that just gets us to 4%. Meanwhile, states like Indiana are close to 40%. Maryland has over 50% of acres in cover crops and other best management practices. So two questions from here. One, you know, are there conversations at the MPCA and the governor's climate subcabinet about aggressively kind of increasing that goal for best management practices? And do you have a sense of how much emissions might be reduced in agriculture if we get 25% of acres covered or 50% of acres covered in these best management practices?
Mr. Kolash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. Yes, that is a major part of the discussions with the climate change subcabinet. And we've been working with the Department of Agriculture and the Board of Soil or Water and Soil Resources for the last 2 years, because what we have found is are that the activities that they were working on that protected water quality also in most cases provide climate benefit and climate reductions. So that's a major focus, and you point out that the magnitude of the number of acres to move forward is important, and we recognize that, and we continue to work as quickly as we can and as unified as we can across the climate change subcabinet to identify ways that we can continue to get more acres into those management practices that will build soil health, protect the climate, and protect water quality. And we've started to work with the University of Minnesota to try to come up with that question, answering that question of what would it look like into the future if we had 20% or 25% or more, and we're continuing to look at that. Obviously, the more that we get, the better. We're also looking at work from other nonprofit groups, other think tanks out there that are showing that there's significant opportunity for both storing carbon on our landscapes and also reducing the emissions. The magnitudes vary depending on some of the assumptions that go into it, so I don't want to state what those are, but they range seeing significant opportunities to reduce the emissions and store the carbon on the landscape, depending on how many acres and what kinds of land practices we're able to put into place.
Representative Lippert, is that?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kolash.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to both of you for the presentation. I just have, I think it's a simple question. I'm wondering if within 2020, obviously, we've had our highways are pretty quiet these days because of COVID. So there's a certain COVID effect on our transportation system. I'm wondering if we have any data that can tell us what that's done in our emissions, if we've learned anything from that data in terms of just reducing the traffic itself on the highways. Thank you.
Mr. Kolash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Christensen, yes, there's been groups that have been looking at that. And the latest numbers that I've seen is that 2020, with all of the emission reductions that we saw from both transportation and some scaling back of industrial emissions, Minnesota will probably see somewhere on the order of a 6-7% emission reduction in 2020 due to the COVID pandemic and the impacts it has on that. But everyone that's looking at that data is thinking that that will be very much a temporary blip in the numbers. So similar to what we saw with the 2009 through 2010 recession, the Great Recession, we saw emissions go down in some sectors just because economic output was going down. We anticipate that the pandemic emission reductions that we see will be on the order of that 6-7%, but they will also be very short-lived because once we work through the pandemic and the vaccination and everyone is itching to get back out and travel, and then we will have to see what is decided for how people start to move around. Do they return to using mass transit, or do they return to using their individual vehicles more? And then will businesses continue to allow people the choice to work from home, or will be there a significant return to in-office work? Those are some of the dynamics that we're not sure about. But we do think that that this will be a short-term blip and will return to pre-COVID emissions within a year or two.
Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks for that answer. Yeah, I hope that there will be more working from home, and that we are going to do, we've learned a lot from COVID in terms of how we can run do our business in Minnesota and elsewhere. So thanks, that's a great answer. And I'm interested to see what we actually, how we come out of this at the end. Thanks much.
Representative Bowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've just got two quick questions, and they are both for Mr. Kolash. So thank you for your presentations today, by the way. The first thing is, when you were talking about transportation, I noticed you mentioned that light and medium duty vehicles make up more than half of the vehicle emissions. I'm assuming there isn't some sort of an inherent inefficiency in that group. So is that really just because they make up the lion's share of the vehicles on the roads today?
Mr. Kolash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Bowe. That's because, yes, they make up a significant amount of the vehicles, and they make up a significant amount of the miles that are used to travel on our roadway. One of the dynamics that we have seen is we have seen the impact of consumer choices moving towards larger vehicles, pickup trucks, SUVs, larger vehicles that are, while they're cleaner, more efficient now than they were a decade ago, we're still, I just have more of them on the road driving more miles, which increases the emissions. So really it comes down to those are upwards of 4 to 5 million of those vehicles operating at some amount on our highways and roadways, and that's where a significant amount of those emissions are coming from, because an enormous proportion of them are burning gasoline or diesel for their fuel, and just there's an inherent emissions that come from the consumption of those fossil fuels.
Very good. Thank you. And Mr. Chair, a second question, if I may. Regarding agriculture, greenhouse gas emissions, is that predominantly from vehicles and equipment? Is it from animals and manure, silage pits and things like that? Or is it a mix of all of those? Or where are the majority of those emissions being generated from?
Mr. Kolash.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowe, for crop agriculture, a significant amount of those emissions are coming from the biogeochemical processing that happens on the land when it is cultivated, and when nitrogen fertilizers are added to the land and they release nitrous oxides, they can release methane, they can release carbon dioxide, and it's really the complex biogeochemical processing that happens whenever you're disturbing soils and using it in that productive use, which is why you can see lower emissions and more stored carbon when land is converted from production to non-production, whether that's prairies or forests. But knowing that we also do need to keep land in production, there are land management practices that help reduce the emissions of those nitrous oxides, the methane and the carbon dioxide, and then also helps within the storing of nitrogen and carbon in the soil that will reduce the emissions from those soils. And then in Minnesota, we also have very high organic matter soils. And when those are disturbed, those are particularly potent in releasing carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases when they're disturbed and used in crop agriculture. So again, a lot of opportunities within that sector, but that's where those emissions are coming from. Within the animal agriculture sector, we're really looking a lot at the methane that's coming off of the manure that's generated by the animal, the animals and the ruminants. That also includes some of their burping, but a lot of it is coming from also just the waste management and how we're managing that and what a lot of that methane's coming from those sources. So those are the major pieces. We do break out the amount of fossil fuel that's used in agriculture for the land production as a separate line within that chart. And I just want to also take an opportunity here to let you know that all of the data and charts that I presented are available in an interactive means on our website at pca.state.mn.us, and it's under the air data. So you can look at that data for yourself and the trends, and certainly contact us if you have any further questions or detailed questions about what's happening.
Very good. Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question either for Mr. Kolash or Ms. Burnett, who would ever want to respond. It's from a close associate of mine who's worked in the electricity generating industry for many years. And he posed these two questions. First one is, currently there's a 1.5% reduction per year that co-ops and municipalities have to reduce their energy use for their community and through efficiencies or whatever. And he said, you know, this really has the effect of simply increasing electricity rates to our consumers. Now, I looked at my electricity rate. I live in a rural area. I used to pay 7.99 cents per kilowatt hour. Now I'm paying 11.99 cents per kilowatt hour. So, you know, I always said, I'll support renewables when the technology is there to provide baseload electricity and it'll actually bring the cost of electricity down. So if you force them to constantly reduce the sale of their product, electricity, you necessarily hurt seniors, our businesses, farms, and everyone else with higher electricity cost. So he wanted to know, and he thinks with little, if any, effect on the environment. So he wanted to know what your thoughts are about that, that there's just no limit to this 1.5%, which means eventually they'll be out of business.
Ms. Burdett.
Chair Long, representative, thank you for the question. So the 1.5% energy savings goal on an annual basis is not an actual requirement to absolutely reduce. So 1.5% year over year, out over year. The 1.5% energy savings goal is based on a rolling 3-year average of sales. So there's a difference in kind of the characterization of how that goal works. While there is a cost to administering conservation programs, there's also sizable benefits that outweigh those costs in terms of net benefits that are achieved. And utilities typically go through a evaluation of what those costs and benefits are to make those determinations. There are a number of factors that go into drivers for increasing or decreasing rates, and I couldn't speak to this specific electric cooperative's scenario in terms of what their rate drivers are. But on average, when you look at conservation and efficiency investments across the state, what we've found through a most recent economic analysis is that for every $1 invested in SIP, we see about a $3.75 return on investment to society. This includes emissions reductions. It includes the avoided need to build additional generation, transmission, and distribution infrastructure, which having to build that infrastructure can also be a driver of rate increases. So it's not a necessarily a straightforward answer. There's a lot of dynamics and variables that go into it. But overall, what we do see is that there are net benefits associated with conservation and efficiency, and primarily through the avoidance of having to build that additional generation, transmission, and distribution infrastructure. And not to mention some of the other societal benefits that are achieved through implementation, such as jobs, emissions reductions, et cetera.
Thank you, Ms. Burdett. And I'll just note, too, that the energy efficiency law does not require investments to be made if they're not economic. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and again, I'm just passing along his comments, and he's been in the industry over 30 years. In fact, he's getting ready to retire. And he just said, you know, we're supposed to purchase more and more infrastructure to create efficiency. And then, so we're spending money on that end, and then we're reducing our sales. He said, there's nothing left to do but raise rates to our consumers. So he thinks you know, these are his words, not mine. And he said it's a ridiculous philosophy. I mean, this goes on ad nauseum, this 1.5%. I mean, if you told me to sell, you know, I own my own business. Well, Glenn, you sell less 1.5% every year. Eventually I'd be out of business. And that's the way it seems. Okay, the second quick question I'd like you to respond to is that how many recs are available? And if, you know, different businesses purchase these renewable energy credits, what's left? I mean, you just print more up if more people want to buy? Or, you know, he's concerned that that some people will be left at the tail end of this without any options. Could you comment on that? Either Mr. Cadet?
Mr. Hagen, if you'd be willing, I think that would be an appropriate question to return to on Thursday. We'll have the commissioner then, and we're going to be discussing the renewable energy standard bill at that point, which is directly on point to that question.
Okay, I'll defer to you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Okay.
We'll put you on the list for Thursday, and we'll make sure to get that question answered.
All right, thank you.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this question will be directed to Mr. Kolash. Can you, you know, from the graph that you have, can you just let me know where does government buildings fall into the different sector? Does it fall into residential, commercial, et cetera?
Mr. Kolash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lee. Those emissions from government operations would fall into the commercial sector.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Kolash, can you tell us how much greenhouse gas emissions are we seeing from our state-owned buildings, and also how much fossil fuel is being used as an energy source for our state-owned buildings?
Mr. Kolash.
Representative Long and Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, I don't have that in this presentation, but the Department of Administration, the Office of Enterprise Sustainability, tracks that for all of state government operations, and they have an excellent online state reporting tool that is what it is called, and it provides that exact data that you're looking for, plus a significant amount of more data on state government operations from energy use, greenhouse gas emissions, and costs, and even the use of fossil fuels in the state fleet to run our vehicles. So I would commend the Department of Administration, their Office of Enterprise Sustainability state reporting tool for that information.
Representative Lee, maybe we'll bring them in front of the committee at some point, and we can have them present that information as well.
Sounds good, Mr. Chair. And then one last question, and maybe this is not for Mr. Kolash, but I just wanted to put it on the record. I think it will be good to know what the administration is going to do with this report with regards to their recommendations for their capital requests that will be coming before our my capital investment committee too. And so I just wanted to put it out there that that's an interest of, you know, some members of that may be interest, you know, of interest to the members here and for certainly for folks in the capital investment committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this would be a question for Mr. Kolash from MPCA. Just you touched on a little bit of the from an agriculture. Kind of reach those goals, or what would you, from an ideal standpoint, think would make a difference?
Mr. Kolash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Swazinski, we don't have a specific target for the amount of acres that would need to be removed from production. We know that that is an option, that there are opportunities for that, but we're not setting it up in a manner where we are really focused on removing agricultural lands from production. And so that because we know that creates a tension. We do need to maintain our agricultural lands in production in Minnesota. It's an important part of our economy. It's an important part of our way of life and our landscape. And so that's why we also do focus significantly on the kinds of land management practices that are available for land that is in production that we can move forward. Because the other thing that we see is that While some of the land management practices may have a lower greenhouse gas or climate benefit if they are put in place versus removal from production, we're also likely to be able to have some of those management practices on many, many more acres, get more acres that remain in production but are in using some of these land practices, more acres than we might be able to get by just removing them from production. So we know that that is something that we are not advancing, and we're not moving forward on just coming up with a goal of removing from production. I think we want to make sure that it all makes sense in the climate basis, but also in the productive lands basis and the protecting habitat and wildlife and the entire package. So we don't have a specific goal for removing productive land in out of production, but we do note that that is an option for some sources and for some lands. But we do focus on the opportunities to put land management practices on productive land to reduce the climate impact.
Representative Zelensky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a follow-up to that, I think like you had some concerns on agriculture and transportation. From a rulemaking standpoint, you guys move through the California standards when it comes to transportation. Are you looking to do mandates in agriculture when it comes to meeting those particular goals that you laid out as far as management practices in the rest, kind of in the same manner that you did with transportation and the California standards?
Mr. Kolesch.
Mr. Chair and Representative Swazinski, right now we are focused on working with our partners in the Department of Agriculture and the Board of Water and Soil Resources to look to build upon and expand upon the existing practices that Minnesota has put into place that will bring more of these land management practices in onto our landscape in the ways it's been working. We're really excited about the work that the Department of Agriculture has done with their Minnesota Water Quality Ag Certification Program. And because there is such an overlap between those practices, protecting water quality and protecting the climate, we're really focused on those kinds of programs at that point moving forward to provide the incentives and provide the encouragement and remove any barriers that we can for those kinds of land management practices to be deployed more extensively across our landscape.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just in general, if we're already reaching our goals in electrical production, why are we continuing to push that to change the goal or, move those goalposts? Focus other areas? I mean, we've talked, pretty much what would actually change the climate. We talk about, we just want to increase, we want to do more. We hear a lot of, we want to do the right thing. From a professional standpoint, whether it be the folks from MPCA or Mrs. Burdett, what would actually change the climate? I mean, we've heard what would be, in a, kind of a dream world of you could just do what you want to do. You guys are the experts. What would have to be done that would actually change it?
Mr. Kolesch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Swiditsky, following what the science is saying and similar things that I'm sure that you heard in the committee last week, and it is looking for emission reductions beyond even the 80% emission reductions that our target is for 2050. And we're starting to see countries and other states aiming for a net zero by 2050. And trying to move ahead on those types of targets so that we are best positioned to address the existential crisis that is climate change, reduce our emissions on the pace that is being called for by the science, and be able to leave a Minnesota to future generations that is similar to what we enjoy and love and experience right now going forward. So, really looking at having to go beyond what the Next Generation Energy Act goals, because those were based on science in 2007, but with in emissions going up across the globe and also not going down fast enough in Minnesota and the United States, of having to have more urgency to move forward with that. And on reducing emissions from the electric generation sector, the focus is because having a clean electric generation sector really is a foundation for the feasible and affordable emission reductions in the other sectors, to use that clean electricity in the other sectors to reduce their emissions and still be able to have our society operate in the way that we anticipate and see it now. So that's why we continue to see and strive for emission reductions in the electric generation sector. And also that Ms. Burdett can talk about, that the cost benefits are building up now, that the renewable energy is now the cheaper sources of electricity, and making sure that it's moving forward on that. So I'll stop with my response there in case Ms. Burdett wants to add something.
Briefly, Ms. Burdett, because we'll have to move to our third speaker. Okay. Looks like Ms. Burdett's
all right. I don't think I could top the climate director's comments on this. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Hornstein, if you don't mind, we'll come back to you as the first questioner when we get to the next round of questions. Mr. Kolash and Ms. Burdett, would you mind sticking around in case Representative Hornstein's question will go to you? I just want to make sure we get in our...
preview, it's for Mr. Kolash. It's a preview, so
okay, I'll great.
Hold so on, Mr. Chairman.
We'll have Mr. Kolash stick around if that's all right. Okay, so we're our third presentation. We've heard the report on whether we're on track or not to meet our greenhouse gas reductions, and we felt like it would be worthwhile to talk about how we could actually achieve those and measure some of the policies that we're proposing. So we're fortunate today to have Robbie Orvis, who's the Director of Energy Policy Design with Energy Innovation, here to present on their energy policy simulator. Mr. Orvis, please unmute yourself and take it away.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Long, and thank you everyone for having me here today. So I'm going to walk through a short presentation just demonstrating one of our tools that we built, the Minnesota Energy Policy Simulator, and walking through a bit how it works online, and then we'll open it up to questions and answers. So share my screen. Okay. So today we're going to discuss the Minnesota Energy Policy Simulator. As Chairman Long mentioned, my name is Robbie Orvis. I'm the Director of Energy Policy Design with Energy Innovation. We are a small, nonpartisan, clean energy and climate think tank. And one of our main things we produce is a tool called the Energy Policy Simulator. We produce these for different countries and states. The tool is completely free and open source and publicly available. So we invite folks to play around with the tool, and if there's any questions about the assumptions or data that goes into the tool, all of that is available. It can be viewed by downloading the tool. The idea behind the Energy Policy Simulator is to help policymakers understand the impacts of energy and environmental policies, to find the best way to meet climate, financial, and other goals, and to make policy decisions that are unbiased and data supported. There are, of course, many policies we could consider that would affect energy use and emissions, and the goal of this tool is to help sort through those different options, understand their combined effects on things like emissions, jobs, state GDP, power sector composition, et cetera, and to help understand which policies are driving the biggest impact. So to do that, we've built the Energy Policy Simulator, which is built in something called a System Dynamics Framework. And the idea is that it allows us to look at the combined effects of many different policies together on things like pollutants and cash flows. The Energy Policy Simulator is a bit of what we would call a hybrid model. So we take output from other top-down models. For example, this might be something like the U.S. Energy Information Administration's Annual Energy Outlook model, or others that provide some of the input data to the tool. And we also take data from other types of bottom-up models. So these might be things that, for example, project the total number of cars in the economy or the total number of building heating systems. And that data is then fed into the model and serves as our business as usual or reference case. And we then track emissions changes from that reference case once we start layering on policies. And you'll see what I mean in a minute when I demo the tool online. The energy policy simulator is an economy-wide model. So we have the three main demand sectors, transportation, buildings, and industry, which includes agriculture here. We also have an electricity module where we track electricity generation and also power plants that are built or retired. We can also look at the production and use of district heat and hydrogen. We can look at carbon capture and sequestration of carbon dioxide emissions in the industry and electricity sectors. We have a whole fuels module where we look at energy production, prices, and taxes. We can look at the impact of research and development breakthroughs on efficiencies or costs and how those affect emissions projections or cost projections in our policy scenarios. We also have a land use module where we track emissions from land use change, and forestry. And all of the sectors of the model produce a lot of outputs, but of course, one of the most important is pollutants. And we track four types of greenhouse gases and then eight other types of pollutants, including particulates and other aerosols that cause health impacts. So one of the other types of outputs we can look at are health outcomes as a result, or a change in health outcomes as a result of our policies that we're enacting. We have both premature mortality as well as a handful of what are called morbidity outcomes. These are things like hospital visits or lost work days as a result of emissions. The model also tracks cash flow, so who pays whom more or less in response to policies. And then we have a macroeconomic model built in as well, so we can look at the impact on jobs and GDP within the state as a result of policies. I won't go through all of this, but just want to note that the model is heavily detailed and subdivided. So in buildings, for example, we have three different types of buildings. And in each of those buildings, we have six different end uses, and we have lots of different fuels for each of those end uses as well. We have a handful of broken out industry groups. We have many different types of electricity suppliers, including both more traditional fossil fuel, non-renewable suppliers, and also several types of renewable power plants. And we have a lot of detail in the transportation sector, including six different types of vehicles across two different modes. And each of those can also have one of seven different vehicle technologies. So we can really drill down into the transportation sector. The model has been pretty extensively reviewed by a mix of national labs, universities, and global partners. And for example, in building the Minnesota Energy Policy Simulator, our team spoke with Frank's team on multiple occasions to solicit feedback and try and ensure that our projections and our data was well aligned with the MPCA. So with that, I'm just going to flip over to the web tool. So this whole model is also accessible online at this link. So https://minnesota.energypolicy.solutions, which is this page here. So this is the landing page for the model. You can see the link up there. And you can access the model by just going here and hitting Enter Simulator. So the first thing we're seeing here when we enter the tool is a graph of the emissions of carbon dioxide equivalent, so this is total greenhouse gases. And this is a projection from 2020 to 2050. You'll see there's a dip here due to COVID, and then there's some recovery of that. But given some of the policies and projected plans, for example, in the power sector of the state, we get this projected emissions trajectory in our business as usual case. Now, there are many different graphs we could look at and different data sets. So maybe we want to look in particular at what different sectors are contributing to emissions in Minnesota. So I would just click on the by sector graph. And now you can see you have the industry sector, electricity. Frank spoke about this earlier, but agriculture is very large here as a share of the state's emissions and so on. And we could look at lots of different outputs. For example, we could look at what the electricity sector is projected at in terms of generation or capacity. We can look at transportation sector vehicle sales, for example. So this is sales of cars and SUVs by engine type. So gray would be gasoline, yellow is battery, and so on. And there's hundreds of different things you can look at all in the online tool. But the main way you interact with this tool is over here on the left-hand side. And this is where you can start turning on and turning off policies as part of your policy scenario. So right now we have no additional policies turned on. We're just looking at our business as usual scenario. So this new scenario line in yellow is right on top of business as usual because we haven't added anything. We could, for example, start adding on policies. So let's say I wanted to do
I think we're waiting on Mr. Orvis's audio to reconnect. Looks like you're back.
Sorry about that. I got disconnected there for a minute. Sorry about that. Okay. So the main way we interact with the tool is by turning on policies, which you can do over here on the left-hand side. Policies are organized by sector. So we have transportation policies, buildings policies, electricity, and so on. So I'm just gonna start here by putting on a 90% clean electricity standard by 2035. And you can see what's happening here is it's starting from 0%. So we're not seeing any impact until the later years. So let me quickly change this. And we're gonna start at the existing share of clean electricity generation in the state. And we're gonna hit that 100% or that 90% in 2035. Okay, and now we can see the model is running in real time and it's estimating the impact on emissions from a 90% clean electricity generation by 2035. And you can start layering on many different policies this way. So you can see now we have a 90% standard, it's also down here. And if we were to go to the electricity sector and look at electricity generation, we would see that we're getting almost all of it from clean electricity sources by 2035. And we can start layering these on and looking at the combined impact of all of our policies. So I want to quickly just transition. We have a couple of other scenarios built in here that come preloaded into the tool, one of which is a nationally downscaled 1.5 degree scenario. So a deep decarbonization scenario, downscaling what we're projecting the U.S. would need to do to the state level by sector. And so when we do that, we have our black business as usual here. And now you see we have this blue national 1.5 degree scenario here that's projecting emissions reductions with all of the policies we have enabled, which are all being recorded here. The list is very long, so I'm not going to go through all of them, but I do want to highlight some of the biggest ones. And one way we can do that is by going through some of the built-in graphics that are here. So one thing here is called the CO2e wedge diagram. And what this graph is showing us is, again, our business as usual scenario, our national 1.5 degree scenario that we've downscaled for Minnesota, and the contribution of different policies to hitting that target. And these are color-coded by sector. So in the transportation sector, which is red, the largest contributing policy is an EV sales standard. So a promotion or requirement to sell a share 100% electric vehicles. And I believe this is being phased in by 2035. In the building sector, building component electrification, so making sure that all newly sold equipment, for example, heating equipment in buildings is electric and not using gas, that's the largest chunk in the building sector and indeed one of the largest policies in this scenario. There's a lot of reductions in the power sector because we are moving to 100% clean electricity, and then we're using that clean electricity to power all of the electric equipment throughout the economy. The industry sector is large as well here. So here in industry, we're moving away from all fossil fuels to a mix of electricity and other lower zero carbon fuel sources like hydrogen. We have some land and agriculture emissions as well. However, here we focus really on energy related emissions in this model, even though agriculture is, of course, a large part of the emissions picture in Minnesota. We can also look at the relative costs of different policies. So for example, we have something called the CO2e abatement cost curve. And what this graph shows is the relative contribution from different policies. So for example, the widest boxes here are showing you the policies that are doing the most to reduce emissions. And the height of the boxes tells you the relative cost of those policies. So as an example, given some of the earlier discussion today, what we tend to see are energy efficiency policies on the left-hand side here, which we know have some upfront costs but tend to pay for themselves pretty quickly. So you see industry energy efficiency standards here has a very negative cost because of all the fuel savings that are accruing. These graphs are also dynamic. So if you change or you want to look at a different policy scenario, the model will update those graphs in real time, and you can look at different outputs for how strong your policies are in different scenarios. There's a lot here, including information on jobs and health outcomes, and not enough time to go through it all. So I want to leave time for Q&A as well. So I'm gonna pause here and open it up for questions and answers.
Thank you very much, Mr. Orvis. This is a really incredibly useful and detailed tool, and we really appreciate you sharing this with us. I promised Representative Hornstein the first question, so we'll go to Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Mr. Orvis. And I think the question I was going to pose for Mr. Kolash, I imagine I could pose for you too. It's related. And I've appreciated both of your presentations and your mentioning transportation, which is very central to addressing the climate crisis. So my specific question, and it could be, again, either for Mr. Orvis or Mr. Kolesh or both, we have talked a lot about electric vehicle infrastructure and the need to build that out in order to have some significant and meaningful greenhouse gas emissions in the transportation sector. So for Mr. Kolesh, I appreciated your mention of the MnDOT Sustainable Transportation Advisory Committee, where we have a recommendation around electrification. And to both of you, what are the specific kinds of infrastructure that would be impactful? What is the extent of its deployment and some of the costs? It sounds like that's somewhat embedded, Mr. Orvis, in your modeling, but also for Mr. Kolesh, how is that, how is the PCA looking at that that question?
Great. We'll go to Mr. Kolesh first, then Mr. Orvis. Mr. Kolesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hornstein, I think what we're looking at are the ability to build out charging infrastructure around transportation corridors to make sure that people can be able to use their electric vehicles to get around the state. Minnesota being a relatively large state, we have distances that we need to cover. So that's the focus that we're taking with our Volkswagen settlement funding and the electric vehicle infrastructure that we were seeking there, is to really build out the opportunities around corridors, travel corridors, to make sure that people have the opportunity to charge, especially through our major traffic and highly used corridors to get throughout Minnesota. We understand that there is, for electric vehicles, most charging happens at home. So we're also looking at the challenges and the opportunities that exist with multifamily housing charging opportunities, because that can be a challenge for some people. If they're living in an apartment, they don't have access to a charge point or a charge port, an outlet or anything, then how do we make sure that they can continue to also benefit from those? And then before I turn over the microphone, I'll just go back to Representative Lippert. We did some math on the side, and If we look at agriculture, it becomes number two by 0.25%. It's a small amount above electric utilities.
Mr. Orvis.
Thank you. I agree with everything that Frank just said. I think one of the things we can do is look at how installing charging infrastructure can help increase the sale of electric vehicles, but there is an implied assumption in our modeling that there is sufficient charging infrastructure. And certainly that charging infrastructure is required in the long term, especially as the share of electric vehicles in the economy grows, but also again, as Frank pointed out, most of the charging that's happening today is happening at home. So it is a long-term requirement, but it's not going to be sufficient to grow electric vehicle sales significantly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. We'll have time for just one more question. Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And thank you for these really excellent presentations. It was very informative. My question also centers around transportation. My concern here is the focus on electric vehicles when a lot of people within our districts could not afford electric vehicles. Certainly not new. I understand that they are cheaper than a standard car if you're buying it new. However, a lot of the folks in my district rely on public transportation, and I'd really like to hear what these plans and how we're looking forward to what public transportation is going to be like as we try to move to this net zero carbon emission economy.
Is that for both Ms. Hollins or Representative Hollins?
Whoever wants to take it on.
We'll start with Mr. Kolesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hollins. That's an excellent point, and it is something that we know is a weakness of electric vehicle policies, is that they have challenges on the equity side and dealing with equity. So we want to make sure, and I apologize if I was not as clear and strenuous on this enough in my presentation, but part of the climate change subcabinet is to focus on that mass transit opportunity, those other opportunities for people to be able to get around, because reducing vehicle miles traveled will also reduce the emissions, but also making sure that other ways of getting around, rather than just using, whether it's an electric vehicle or a gasoline vehicle or a biofuel vehicle, anything like that, that's not the only option. And so working with Metropolitan Council was part of the subcabinet to look at how they can expand and make more affordable the mass transit options. They're also looking at the use of electric buses and other electric options so that they can reduce the tailpipe emissions for when they provide those services. And then also working with MnDOT, and this is something that came up when their Sustainable Transportation Advisory Council, of understanding that we do need to have policies and strategies that address those exact points that you brought out. It can't all be just about transitioning to electric vehicles, because we do need to provide other options for getting around and being able to move around that are more affordable, but also for the choices that people will make. Some people will simply choose not to want to have the invested cost in a vehicle, and they want other ways to get around. And how do we make sure that we have the right policies and strategies in place that provide those options to them?
Mr. Orvis.
Thank you. It's a great question. And again, just to echo the same points and focus in on one in particular, I think the opportunity for electric buses is really promising and exciting. That technology has come a long way. And while there's some additional upfront cost to purchase those buses, they tend to have much, much lower maintenance costs. And of course, they have much lower fuel costs as well. And so there's a big cost improvement potential that's there. And of course, there's a climate improvement potential. And you also avoid all of the localized air pollution from diesel buses, which is a major concern, especially in the communities that are relying heavily on public transit. So I think, to the extent electric buses can become a bigger part of the public transit equation, that can really help decarbonize the transportation sector, and also brings a ton of other benefits, including cost and public health benefits with it.
So unfortunately, that's what we have time for today. I'm sorry, Representative Bowe, we weren't able to get to your question, but hopefully I can connect you with Mr. Orvis to get your question answered offline. Thank you so much to our testifiers today. This was a really terrific hearing. We're going to be hearing on Thursday the 100% Clean Energy Standard Bill. The language will be posted for that later today. There won't be any action on the bill on Thursday. It will just be public testimony. If individuals would like to testify, please be in touch with our committee administrator ahead of time to let him know. And then we posted our two hearings for next week as well. On Tuesday, we will be hearing the ECO Act on our energy efficiency standards and taking action on the bill on that day. And then Thursday, we will be returning to the 100% bill for any amendments. So that's our schedule going forward. Thank you all very much. Our next meeting is 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, and our remote meeting is adjourned.